Our guest today is a British psychologist and professor of psychology and economics of the University of Southern California. She is also a distinguished visiting professor at INSEAD near Paris. She was previously Vice Dean of Social Science at Dornsife College. She is one of the world's leading scientists researching habits and behavioral changes. We will learn today that willpower is not enough to practice good habits. Or, as she said it in an interview with the German business magazine Brand 1, strong-willed people are good at choosing a helpful environment.
Since more than 4 years, we have been on our way to new work. How can a topic that plays such an important part in our everyday life create more meaning in our lives again? How do we get people to draw strength and motivation from their daily work again? How can one succeed in living a happy, healthy, productive, and fulfilling life, even in such difficult times? Why is it so important that we think about our habits? We are looking for methods, role models, experiences, tools, and ideas that bring us closer to the core of new work. We are always concerned with the question of whether everyone can really find and live what they really, really want in their innermost being. How can we make sure that each and every one of us will find their inner driving force? You are it. On the way to new work, today with Wendy Wood.
Hi, Christoph. Hi, Michael. Great to be here.
Hi, Wendy. That is so nice that we have the chance to talk to you. Welcome. As we learned in the couple of minutes before, you are in Washington, D.C. We are in Germany, so there are about 6 hours between us. But for me, it feels as we are sitting in the same room. And I do hope that we can create an atmosphere that our listeners will have the same feeling. So I think it's our role to give you the feeling that you are sitting with us in our kitchen. Wendy, we always start our podcast with a question of all questions. At least some of our guests are calling this question of all questions. How did you become the person you are today?
That's such a broad question to ask. Let me explain. So I'm a researcher and a behavioral scientist, and I think that question is most important in thinking about how I started to study habits and how that became such a central focus in my research. Because there's so many interesting questions you could ask about people. Why would habits be a central one? And in fact, some of my colleagues have said, but habits are so boring. Why would anyone study them? Well, I didn't start out trying to study habits. That wasn't my intent. I was interested, when I was a graduate student, in how people change their attitudes and their beliefs. And there's great models for that in psychology, great theories, great data. What struck me, though, is that we don't have such good models about how people change their behavior. There's something different about behavior than about what people say and what people think. It seemed to follow different rules than people's beliefs. And we can all see this in our own life, right? We all know how to live a healthier life. We know what we should do. We know we should be going to bed at a certain time to get ourselves enough rest at night. We should be eating certain things. We should be exercising regularly. We all know this. So we've been informed and influenced to change our attitudes, to know what's right in terms of our health. But the challenge is that many of us actually don't do it. And so there's something about behavior that doesn't always follow from our attitudes. And so what is that thing? Why is it that people's behavior so often is discrepant from what they believe? And that's what spurred me to start studying habit, because habit is at the core of a lot of what we do that we're not really thinking about and evaluating. And that's how my research got focused on habit and why I've continued to work in the area and why, unlike some of my colleagues, I think it's really fascinating. It's one of the most interesting questions, I think, that we can ask about people. Mm.
Do you remember when? Oh, sorry.
I think we have exactly the same question. Do you remember the time when you actually felt that this is the topic you want to dive into? I think, Michael, that was the question you also
had,
right?
Absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Well, I don't think that there is a certain time or incident or context. For most of us researchers, it develops as you start to investigate something and realize, oh, I really don't understand this. Mm. It really has different rules, different processes, different framework than what I've been using so far. And that's the challenge that makes you start to think, oh, I really do need to study this. Mm. And my students get excited about it. So it's seeing the what we don't understand yet, I think, that starts to spur people's interest and keep them engaged, which is a very abstract answer, I know. It's not a specific event, but that's really what sort of drives most researchers, I believe.
Mm. Do you remember a setting, a framing that you ask in the beginning with your students or a study or something you did, like to get closer to that topic when you came up with the first questions about it?
Yeah. So one of the first questions we asked was, so how pervasive are people's habits? We know that since B.F. Skinner and his pigeons, that animals have habits. And in fact, that's how we train our dogs, right? Mm-hmm. Is we train them to have certain habits. So we know that animals learn through habits. But in humans, for a long time, we thought, well, habits are just sort of the simple one-off things that you do, right? Like brushing your teeth or putting a seatbelt on if you're driving a car. And there wasn't much understanding of how much they pervade our daily life. So we ran a study where we followed people and we beeped them once an hour and asked them what they were thinking and what they were doing and then how often they'd done it, just like that, in that context, in the past. And what we found is that 43% of the time that we contacted people, they were repeating behaviors they had done almost every day in that context. And they were thinking about something other than what they were doing. So they were responding automatically without really making decisions, without deliberating about what they should do, what the opportunities were. They're just repeating what they've done in the past. And that was surprising because it applied to pretty much every domain of life. Mm-hmm. It isn't just brushing your teeth. It's when you're talking to people that you've talked to in the same way, say your partner at breakfast or the driver of a bus that you take to work every day. Those kinds of social interactions also have a habit component to them. We tend to say the same things in the same ways that we've done in the past without thinking a whole lot about it. So there's a habit piece to even parts of our behavior that we think are more, flexible, thoughtful, engaging. 43% of the time, we're just not making decisions about what to do.
We are autopilot.
Exactly.
I wanted to ask the question, where do you see the most important use cases for habits? But I think you gave the answer already. It's in our whole life. It's in every area of life. So, or do you think there is something special about habits where you say in this area of life, it's more important than in others?
No, I think it pervades all parts of our lives. And understanding habits then becomes really important. It becomes important for reaching our goals, for achieving what we want to in life, for being happy, for our well-being. If habits are that pervasive, then we really need to understand how to make them work for us instead of just sort of struggling with them.
What are the most important factors in building a habit?
Well, we build habits naturally. You don't have to make a decision. It's not like exerting willpower and white-knuckling through something. Instead, habit learning is something that our brains do without us intending it. So we're forming habits all the time. When you repeat a behavior in a particular context and get a reward, you have, each time you do it, you are incrementally strengthening that habit memory so that the next time you're in that context, the behavior that comes to mind without you even making a decision is the one that you've repeated in the past. And eventually, it becomes just, as you say, automatic. We're on autopilot. The behavior comes to mind. It's worked for us in the past, so we just do it again without thinking. We have more important things to fuss about in our lives than the basic habitual things that repeat every day.
But if you mentioned that habits are necessary to, if we want to reach goals, ambitious goals, habits are one tool to reach the goal. So if I want to use habit as a concept, as a tool, what do I have to do that they become a habit? I mean, there are some rules like you need 21 days. I don't believe this. Other rules stay tiny. It has to be something very, very little. People are talking about prompts, context, and so on. So what do you think is really needed if I want to use it on purpose?
Well, there are a couple of things to keep in mind. Yes, there are lots of rules out there. First, there are lots of rules out there. Rules can be helpful sometimes. Make sure that the rules you use are based on research data and not people's assumptions about what's worked in their own lives. I would say that probably the thing that people overlook the most in forming new habits is the importance of the context we're in. We're so used to controlling our own behavior and making decisions. We think that that's really the key to behavior change. So if there is, say you want to, you mentioned that you're writing a book. Writing a book requires a huge amount of work and commitment. And when you start, you think, well, I need to make sure that I have a lot of self-control. I need to rely on my willpower in order to make this happen. But if you observe really successful writers, they're not engaging in that sort of self-control, self-denial, effortful control of their behavior. Instead, they tend to write out of habit. They have set up the context, their living context, to make it easy for them to repeatedly write on a regular basis. And they just follow that pattern. And when I was writing my book, that's indeed what I did. I get up in the morning, I sat in front of my computer, and I just worked for a couple of hours every morning. And so I got the writing out of the way before I went to work.
So it's the what I mentioned in the beginning is this in creating the right environment makes it easier to follow your habit.
Exactly. If I had to make a decision every morning, am I going to sit in front of my computer? Do I want to? Is it actually a good way to work? Or is there a better way? If I was making all of those decisions, I'd be exhausted by the time I got to the writing, to the actual work I was trying to do. And that's what habits do, is they streamline the decision-making for you so that you can go ahead and do the thing that you really want to do. You can be productive in the way you want to be productive. And habits develop. You repeat behavior much more easily, much more readily when the context is supportive, when it makes it easy for you to do it.
What do you do with contexts that are hard to control, situations that, let's say, change a lot of contexts, like the COVID situation for many people in the last year that threw a lot out of the actual path, or let's say you have family situations that you didn't plan, things that struggle up. How do you deal with that, and how do you then streamline the habits regarding to the situation or the other way around?
Yeah, this has been a tough year and a half for many people. And one of the things that made it so tough, I think, is that everyday contexts were disrupted. Mm. So that means that our habits that we're used to, that allow us to sort of live simply without making decisions, all of a sudden got changed. They got disrupted. So we had to start making decisions about what to do. We had to cope with losing jobs, with kids being at home, being schooled remotely, with our partner all of a sudden being around all the time. All of these things, and we couldn't go to the shops in the way that we normally did. And some, I don't need to recount all of the changes that people went through. That was really a difficult time because we had to make decisions about things that had been automatic and habitual up until then. For many of us, that was just a real challenge. But it's also an opportunity because it allows us to rethink a lot of the things that were automatic. And a great metaphor for this is a strike that occurred in the London Underground, in the tube system, in 2014. It was a two-day strike of many of the workers of the London Underground. And it forced people to try out new routes because only some stations were closed. And of course, it's London, so it was raining. People had to use the tube. They had to figure out how to get to work without getting too wet. And it was a challenge for a lot of the people who use the underground. But we also learned that it really worked. It was a benefit for 5% of the commuters that day, because they found new routes to get to work more quickly. Mm. So they were able to take advantage of it. They could have tried out these new routes any time, right? Mm. So because the London Underground was open up until those 2 days. But they didn't, because they were working on habit. When their habits were disrupted, then they had to find new ways to get to work. Mm. And this benefited some, a minority, but it was a benefit to some of the commuters. And in the same way, when our context, our everyday context change, our life context change, it forces us to try new things. And some of my friends reported that although having kids at home learning remotely was a real challenge. It was a real problem for these kids. And it was a problem for working parents. They got closer to their kids and they understood more of what their kids were doing at school. So they learned some things. And the families got a bit closer. So that's probably not the normative experience that everybody had, but it's an example of how you can use disruption to your benefit. Mm-hmm. You can make new decisions about how to interact with the people in your family, what to do on a daily basis that actually work better for you than they did before. So those disruptions are a challenge, absolutely, Christoph, but they also can be used to your benefit.
Mm-hmm. I have to say that this really resonates with me. And if I go back to the first week of lockdown, I had to start to travel, and travel was always a big part who defined who I am. I was 4 to 6 times in the year I was in the US. I was really flying around the world, meeting people, blah, blah, blah. And I learned that this is not what I am. I thought it was what I am. And I had the chance through COVID to redefine the way I work, the way I communicate, the way I interact. And it helped me to restart relationships in my life, which were at a difficult period of time. And I think I read this in one of your articles that a big change really is a good chance to try to come up with some new habits. I mean, not for everyone. As we know, if you struggle with your kids in lockdown and you have to do 3 jobs at the same time, you may not have the time to reinvent yourself. I know I'm in a privileged situation, but I really can feel what you're saying. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And we go through more sort of minor examples of this when we change jobs, when we move house, when we start new relationships, when we have a new partner. We have a chance to sort of rethink some of the decisions we've made and then decide what habits are working for us and which ones are not so beneficial anymore. It's that change in context that is no longer activating the old behaviors that gives us that opportunity. It's exhausting. So be prepared when we go through these. We're all prepared when we go through these changes to be a little distracted, overwhelmed sometimes. But it's still an opportunity to rethink some of the decisions we've made.
There would be a question that comes to my mind of also regarding the situation. I felt the situation a bit different than Michael, but we discussed it already. That is due to family situation. And I'm the type of guy then also like Michael, loving to perform, loving doing things. But what you're saying, changing too many contexts at the same time really is struggling, I have to say, for me still today. And the question would be now to use it as a chance, reflect about it and say like, okay, is there an amount of things we can change at the same time? Let's say develop a habit of writing. I love the idea. Getting up at 5, slept through 7 hours without kids waking up at night, peeing in the bed. Getting with a cup of coffee to the writing desk after I've meditated. It worked years before the kids. It doesn't work today. So whenever I have the feeling, I can write right now because nobody's crying. Nobody killed himself. I can write right now. Then I start, but I flip over everything else. Everyone who actually relied on me today is then distracted by that. So is there an amount of things we should change at a certain time and like give room to ourselves saying, this is too much right now?
Well, I think that what you're describing is something that many of us learned during the lockdowns, which is forgive yourself for a lot of the angst and the struggle. you need to be kind to yourself and not expect, this is what I told all of my students, don't expect yourself to be able to produce in the same way that you did before. It's going to take a while to get used to change. And so be patient with yourself as you start to form these new habits so that you can be productive again. I completely understand your comments, Christoph, about writing and children. I have two sons who I adore, and when they were little, I actually learned to write at the kitchen table. And it, just because it was efficient, because they so often needed me there. And when they weren't needing me, it gave me a small window to do get some writing done. So if I had my computer out on the kitchen table already, I was halfway there. And you're laughing.
Yeah, because
you've had similar experiences.
My girlfriend came in today and asked, "What happened to your kitchen?" There is an explosion in the kitchen, and I was sitting in the middle of a mess just with the laptop writing because I said, the kids are gone today, I'm writing, and the rest is a mess. So I have a picture here that maybe I should share it in the podcast. I take a picture later. So yeah, I get the idea. Okay.
It sounds like my kitchen. You just have to pick up and fit in whenever you can with little children. And actually, we did some research early on, that study I was telling you about with 43% of your day. We started out thinking, well, you know, there are probably some people who are really habitual and others who are more spontaneous, because that's the way we think, at least, about people. But that didn't turn out to be true in our research. Pretty much everyone had about the same level of habit. Now, let me say that's not exactly correct, because there are some people who have a very addictive pattern. And for those people, it seems that they form and rely on habits a bit more than the rest of us do. But they're an unusual group. Most of the rest of us form and rely on habits to about the same extent, except people who live with others, especially little children, because children disrupt your habits. They're growing, their needs change, they are active, they're always doing things. It's hard to maintain habits when you live with little kids. So it's just part of it. And you just get used to it. It's part of the charm.
Yeah. there's one part of habits which we all do not like. It's the bad habits. And we are eating too much. We are smoking. Not me, but others. I'm eating too much sometimes, but I do not smoke. We have so many bad habits. And I read in one of your articles that part of getting to new habits is to get rid of old habits. What is the way to stop bad habits? Are there any recipes, any tips you could give us?
Well, keep in mind that good and bad habits are pretty much the same. Mm-hmm. That the only difference between them really is that good habits are meeting your goals right now and bad habits aren't. So it's really your goals that are the issue. That's the difference between good and bad habits.
So I think there's another difference. One difference is that many, many bad habits, like, let's say, binge watching Netflix and eating pizza is fun in the beginning and you pay the price later. And good habits like running around our inner city Lake Alster is not so much fun when it's cold outside, but you get the reward later. So it's this bad habits are fun and good habits are not fun. That's I think, the truth. What do you think?
Well, I think what you've described are behaviors that are hard to form into a habit and behaviors that are easier to form into a habit. And that's actually the key, right? So taking those behaviors that might be harder for you to form into a habit and making them fun.
Mm-hmm.
I was a runner for a long time, and I absolutely loved running outside. It was a great way to get exercise. I used to get up early in the morning and do that before my sons got up, and it was just wonderful. But you get older, it doesn't work so well anymore. And I tried to find something that was comparable. And I actually bought myself an elliptical machine, thinking if I owned it, it's easy, it's here, I'll be more likely to do it.
Mm.
No. An elliptical is the most boring thing in the world. It was really hard to make myself do it, and I didn't use it for a while until I figured out that I could read trashy novels and listen to podcasts that I normally wouldn't have time to listen to while I work out. And that made it fun. So finding ways to make the behaviors enjoyable, enjoyable in the moment when you do them, just like, as you said, eating pizza and binge watching on Netflix, those things are enjoyable in the moment. If you can make those behaviors that you want to engage in enjoyable in the moment, that does two things. One is it increases the likelihood that you'll repeat it again in the future. So you'll be more likely to form a habit because you'll be repeating the behavior. And the second is that when you experience a reward doing something you like, for me, getting on the elliptical and reading trashy novels, my brain releases dopamine.
Mm.
And dopamine is a neurotransmitter. We think of it as the feel-good chemical, but it does so many things in the brain. One of the things it does is it helps us build habits. It connects the context we're in with the response we just gave, so that the next time we're in that context, the response comes to mind.
Und hier kommt der ganz kurze Werbeblock. Und diese Werbepause dreht sich um den Podcast Bewusst gemacht. Das ist der Manufaktum-Podcast. Und für die, die sehr bewusst auch schon unterwegs sind oder vielleicht auch einfach so online auch kaufen oder auch offline kaufen, die kennen bestimmt Manufaktum. Manufaktum ist ein Unternehmen, das für bewussten Konsum steht. Also quasi alles, was der Gegenentwurf ist zur heutigen Wegwerfmentalität. Und das Handelsunternehmen steht schon sehr lange für Dinge, an denen man sehr lange Freude hat, Produkte, die reparierbar sind, die langlebig sind, die funktional sind. Und die Geschichte hinter diesen Produkten, das ist das, worum es in dem Podcast geht. Die Moderatorin Theresa Frigger hat alle zwei Wochen Gäste, Kolleginnen, Herstellerinnen, Expertinnen aus der Forschung und Wirtschaft und diskutiert eben das Thema verantwortungsvoller Konsum oder eine ressourcenschonende Lebensweise. Und es startet jetzt demnächst die zweite Staffel, in der es vor allem darum geht, gewohnte Routinen zu hinterfragen. Also sprich, wie kann ich im Alltag durch kleine Verhaltensänderungen Großes bewirken? Das ist ein Riesenthema, das haben wir auch schon viel diskutiert bei uns. Und das ist besonders spannend, weil wir können eben viele Dinge durch Kleinigkeiten bewirken. Und ja, das ist der Podcast Bewusst gemacht, der Manufaktum-Podcast. Und den findet ihr auf allen gängigen Streaming-Plattformen. Und den Link gibt es ansonsten hier auch in Shownotes.
I have a question regarding dopamine in that special case. I'm trying to remember his name. There is a Stanford professor who made an experiment with monkeys explaining the dopamine curve, how it sparks up in the very beginning, even before the exercise. And he explained in that experiment that this dopamine creates a certain pattern in the brain, especially when you get addicted to something. What I would like to know is what I remember from back then, just very foggy, that whenever the brain learned this pattern once, it will always remember it. Let's say sugar kicking in, or let's say a bad habit kicking in. And once we fall back into that habit, the brain remembers immediately and we are pulled back into this bad habit. Is it that we built a muscle with a good habit that keeps us away from the bad habit? Or is it that we are pulled back immediately if we do it once? You know what I mean? This pattern in the brain that we will never forget again once we had it.
Yeah, there are some people who, some researchers who believe that once you learn a habit, your brain never forgets, that habit memory sticks with you. Because habits take a long time to develop, they also take a long time to decay. Mm-hmm. So whether or not the memory is with you always, I don't know. But it is the case that old contexts can activate behaviors that you think you've stopped or that you've figured out how to control. So yeah, you can fall back into old habits by being in old contexts. Mm. But that's also a key to having the right habits, right? Is being in contexts that make it easy for you to repeat the behaviors you want so that they then form into good habits, the ones that you want to have. Of course, when we this discussion about good and bad habits is always in it's in transition, because what's a good habit now could end up being a bad habit in the future. Something that is working for you now can become sort of stale and old in the future. Even if you enjoy it now, right? It can become something that's not so pleasurable in the future that you want to change. So part of the challenge for all of us is to make sure that our habits are working for us now. Because the fact they were working for us before doesn't mean much. Mm. We have to continually be changing them.
What are your most important personal habits? Do you want to share them with us?
Well, I think I've shared a couple already. Yeah. My writing habit that allowed me to write a book. My exercise habit. I try to do things like, so eating healthfully. Mm-hmm. I used to buy fruits and vegetables raw, just from the farmer's market, not cut up, not prepared. And I would find that I sometimes didn't eat them before they went bad, which is the problem with eating healthfully. So I learned that although it's more expensive, buying prepared fruits and vegetables works better for my lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I'm not that talented a chef, a cook, and I don't enjoy it that much. So if it's already prepared and cut up and halfway cooked in the refrigerator, even though it's more expensive, I'm more likely to eat it.
Mm-hmm. So that's a very good example for context. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a system. I mean, this is what you were talking about, right? Like having a system that helps you to keep it going. Same with exercising. Mm-hmm. People who have a trainer, you could say they're lazy or they have a system.
Oh, that's a great, yes. Having a trainer, if you can afford it, is a wonderful innovation, because it gives you someone to talk to when you're working out, and presumably someone you like, as well as actually gets you to exercise. And it schedules it into your life. You have to pay for it, so it continually reminds you of your commitment. There's all kinds of good things about having a trainer. Mm.
Should we start to teach the topic of habits very early, our kids? Do you think it's good to tell them that they could use and build up habits to have a more happy life? Or do you think this is something where you have to be a grown-up for?
Well, absolutely, children can benefit from understanding about habits and from watching us, their parents, act on beneficial habits on a regular basis. But habits require a certain neural maturity. And parts of the brain don't mature sufficiently to form habits in the way that we understand them until kids get to be maybe even college age. So this is me speculating, but I think that's one reason why kids really like structure and repetition and routine in their family, because that provides them with the same sort of framework that adults get from their habits. But kids have to rely on the people around them to help provide that structure. But again, that's just me speculating.
I can feel that from talking to parents, like fellow parents with other kids in the same age, saying when they didn't have a structure with their parents back then, they say they really had a hard time dealing with that, and now trying to do that with their kids, even if it's hard for them because they never learned it. That would be an interesting question to make a study about it and see how that affects. It's the keeping the structure in these full and packed days is really tough. And we had an interesting discussion within my team where we have a lot of kids, young age, saying that it's very hard for people without kids to understand how it, is it with kids. And it's similar in the whole diversity discussion, saying like, how would you understand another person? It's the same thing, understanding a situation, and it's really tough not to discriminate others with kids in certain situations if you don't understand what you're doing there. And this is launching a whole new chapter for us, like discussing stuff and like trying to understand. So here's my question: how do we synchronize habits in large teams or families or corporations or whatever? How do we transform it, like take it from us to the team?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is something that, as you say, organizations struggle with, corporations struggle with. It's often thought about in the context of, these are terms that are used in industry, exploiting existing practices. And that's the habit, right? Existing practices, you're doing the same thing over and over again, you're exploiting what's known, as opposed to exploring something new, innovating, changing up to meet new workforce demands, new product demands, new consumer demands. So there's always a tension between exploiting and exploring. And you can think of startups, new startup companies, as being really big on the exploring, not having much procedure, established procedure to exploit. And then some big established companies have a lot of procedures to exploit, but aren't so good at innovating for exploration. And that's how we get things like Blockbuster Video, right, dying out, is companies are too busy exploiting and they're not putting their effort into exploring. So it's always a balance. And you've described it sort of in terms of families. Families have the same issue as well, which is how do we keep up with children's needs and the changing school environment and the new friends kids have and all of the new social media challenges that kids are experiencing these days.
Not just kids.
Exactly. But I think kids are, kids are more challenged by it. How do we keep up with all that? And then still provide enough structure, enough stable practices, things that have worked in the past, so that there's a sense of moving forward, of productivity, of it's a challenge that all groups face. And so that's another reason why we think habits are so important, is they pervade not just individuals' experiences, but also they're relevant to broader groups of people and organizations. Yep. Understanding how habits work and when it's appropriate to rely on them and when you have to do something different. You have to be flexible, innovate.
I think there are some very good examples. One I love is from the area of sport, which is the New Zealand rugby team. They call themselves the All Blacks. And they're doing a dance before they start a game and they do the dance after the game. So I think there where the habits and rituals come along. This is one example I like a lot. And there's one industry where I believe they are very good at using habits, which is the airline industry. They call this tool crew resource management because they had so many problems because they mix their teams every time new. And so they have a special training module to make sure that teams are aligned. So they have lots of checklists and protocols and behaviors, which I think are a sort of setup of habits. And I think they demonstrate that if you try to form habits for groups and everyone likes and appreciates it to live with these habits, a team and a group can be so much stronger than without.
Exactly. And that's a great example because, as you say, on airlines, the teams are constantly changing, but yet they have to keep doing very much the same thing. So how do you get that? You need that structure, that habit that everyone has bought into and everyone knows.
What I'm struggling with is right now is we have so big problems with this planet, whether it's nature, whether it's religion, whether it's politics. We are in a period of time where we really have big problems. Do you believe that the concept of habits could help us to solve some of these problems, or would this be a too big role for habits?
Oh, I think that habits are very much involved in many of the challenges we experience right now. What understanding habits does is it really helps us focus on how the contexts that we're in are responsible for solutions or are continuing to create these problems. And let me give you an example. So there was one of my favorite studies right now is an old one that was done in a 4-story building. And this will get back to your question in just a minute.
Perfect.
It's a bit of a digression, but it's a good metaphor to answer this question. It was a study done in a 4-story building. And what the researchers were interested in is how do they get people to take the stairs instead of the elevator in this building? And so they started off very much as in the way that you and I would, if we were trying to change our behavior, right? We try to think of all the reasons why we should take the stairs. So they put up big signs outside the elevator. Take the stairs. It's good for your health. Burns calories. Good cardio. Workout. Take the stairs. No effect. So they decided they would try different signs. Take the stairs. It's good for the environment. Good for your carbon footprint. Take the stairs. No effect. So these are very smart researchers, and they decided to actually start to manipulate the context people were in. So what they did is they slowed the closing of the elevator door by 16 seconds. And that reduced elevator trips by a third. And the amazing thing was that after a month, when they put the elevators back to their normal speed, people kept taking the stairs because they had formed a habit. So I think when we try to change people's behavior, get them to recycle, get them to use less energy, get them to exercise. We inform them. We convince them of the right thing to do. We tell them they should take the stairs because it's good for their health. It's good for the environment. It doesn't have a great deal of impact until we start varying, until we start making it more difficult. We change the context to make it more difficult for people to do things that are not good for them and for the environment. You're not taking away people's choice, right? People in the study still could have gotten on the elevator. They just have to wait a little bit longer for the door to close.
Is this already nudging? Would you say this slowing down the speed of the doors is like nudging?
It is a kind of nudge. Mm-hmm. Now, nudging includes both the signs. Nudging is a very broad term. It doesn't apply specifically to habits. Only certain types of nudges will work with our habits. And those are the ones that change our context in some way so that the habit becomes more difficult, it becomes less accessible, it becomes harder to do. Those are the kinds of nudges that will affect habits.
So, for example, and
go ahead, please, Christoph.
So if I understand it correctly, putting the iPhone on grayscale would be a change of context, making it harder for me to like enjoy using this device, for example. Or, I don't know, what are other good examples? I'm just looking for, like, Michael, when you said using the Netflix in SD instead of HD or 4K, making it so bad on the large screen that you say, like, I don't enjoy it anymore. I don't know, like something like that. So this is what you mean by changing the context?
Exactly. Changing context could be as little as just turning your phone upside down, putting it face down so that you don't see the notifications. So it's not as accessible. You have to make a decision then to pick it up and look at it. These very small changes have great impact. So, for example, retailers, there's a saying in stores that eye level is bye level. And that's because we're all just much more likely to buy the things that are easily accessible. That's why they put the really cheap stuff down by our feet, because we're less likely to reach down there and get it. In fact, there was a very clever study that showed recently that it's not really even eye level. It's reach level. So it's at the level of your arms where you're more likely to pick things off the shelf, which is slightly lower than eye level. We are so influenced by what's easy and what's difficult. It's not how we think of our behavior, right? We think we make decisions to buy certain things. We make decisions to take the stairs or take the elevator. So often, it's really just what is easy. And so to get back to your question, Michael, about challenges that our societies face right now, it's really up to broader institutions, policy, to help people make the right decisions. It's very hard. We can all do this to a certain extent in our own lives, but it's very hard for us to make the kinds of big changes in context that are actually going to influence people's behavior without some help from policymakers and from broader institutions. And it just becomes really important once you understand habits, it becomes really important to understand how context is influencing our behavior and our decisions.
I mean, we see that now, wearing masks, giving a fist bump instead of shaking hands and stuff like that, changing the habit we're into in everyday life. What comes to my mind regarding that, I'm now catching up with the question, Michael, you obviously raised, Is there a certain sense that we can target that is easier in changing habits? So let's go back to the elevator example. Let's say, is smelling a better sense than experiencing waiting, for example? Let's say the elevator stinks or something. I don't know, like changing the habit. Is there one of the senses that we have where the impact is much larger than with others?
That's an interesting question. I don't know that any research has looked at that.
You can do do the research.
Exactly.
I will support you.
Next year.
Oops. Yeah. But one of the examples that I like the best of this is what Paris did during the lockdowns, is that they opened up a lot of the streets and made them not for cars, but for bicycles and pedestrians. Mm-hmm. And so they are trying to change how people get around. And they did this in a very smart way because people's lives were already disrupted. Mm-hmm. So closing down these streets didn't seem like such a huge change because people were already going through the lockdowns and the stress of living through this pandemic. And so the changes were easier to accept. They started to seem like, well, so now I have more choices, right? I can drive on this street or I can ride my bike or walk on that one. And with those changes, then Parisians will be changing their choices, their typical mode of transportation. It was really a very smart move, I think, on the part of the mayor of Paris and others to do that. In the US, we haven't been quite as thoughtful, perhaps, in our policies surrounding transportation.
Last questions before we have our last two questions we have with every guest. Is there any, or did you see in your research, any difference in cultures? So does cultural influence habits or not?
Oh, definitely it does. It doesn't, I mean, habits are a very basic learning mechanism. It's how your dog learns. It's how whales learn. All mammals learn through habit. But the exact types of habits that people acquire depend on the context they're in, what the experience is rewarding. One of my favorite examples is sitting around with some Danish friends of mine talking about what kind of food children like. What's comfort food? And in the US, it's of course pizza, it's peanut butter sandwiches, it's anything that's fatty and sweet. They were like, no, that's not what children like. Children like herring. And to us in the US, that just sounds so odd. It sounds impossible. But it really depends on what is rewarding in the context in which you live. It makes perfect sense to a Dane.
Cool. Thank you so much. So our last two questions are, we have to ask them because we are hitting the hour now. The first one is, where did you get your inspiration from? Were there any books in your life which really influenced you or people, so what did inspire and does inspire you?
I think I am inspired by other researchers, particularly ones that can not only think very concretely about problems, but also very broadly about the human condition. And there are so many out there, it's hard to even begin.
Can you just name one for us?
Richard Feynman is everyone's favorite scientist, I think. He is, he's hilarious as well as very thoughtful about human behavior as well as about his own discipline, physics. And I think that's what it takes, is understanding how people work, not just not just the details of your own discipline.
Cool. Thank you very much. And the last question is our bucket list question. If you could write three things on your bucket list, one experience, a thing you want to do in the next years, one thing you would love to learn, and one thing you would love to give back to society, what would be the three things?
Well, the thing that I really wanted to do, I actually did this year. So I teach at the University of Southern California, but I'm living in Washington, D.C. right now because both of my sons live here. And my husband and I moved here during the pandemic. So getting my family back together again was a real issue for me during the pandemic. That was a bucket list thing. And I was fortunate enough to be able to do that. What that means in the future, who knows? But right now it's working. So I'll keep that. So one thing I want to do, one thing I want to
learn.
What's the next? Learn. Mm-hmm. I would love to learn to be a better cook. So as part of writing this book, I went up to the Culinary Institute of America in Napa Valley, and I got to shadow some beginning chefs for a week in order to learn something really basic about cooking, which is how chefs learn to do mise en place.
Wow.
And that is the practice of setting up everything before you start cooking, measuring things out, chopping them, because it's a great metaphor for forming a new habit, is to make it easy for you to do the same thing over and over again. And in the case of these beginning chefs, they were creating amazing dishes and were able to do it repeatedly. And so understanding how they got there and how they were doing that was really fun. And it made me realize exactly how bad a cook I am and how much I have yet to learn. So that's something that I love to eat. So why not learn actually how to do it right?
Yeah.
That's something I'd like to learn.
And the last thing, what would you love to give back to society? I think you already gave lots back, but is there any topic, if you could choose one?
I would love to help address climate change at this point, to try to help people understand what the levers are to change people's behavior so that we can reduce the impact we're having on the climate. And that's what some of my most recent writing has been about, because I think it's really the issue for us going forward. I mean, you identified several challenges earlier, Michael, that we're all facing, but I think climate is the one that's going to influence our children the most. Yeah. And so trying to understand how we got here, why we're so stuck, and then how to change is really central, I believe, to handling climate change.
I think this is a very good end of our conversation. Thank you so much, Wendy. It was such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, my pleasure completely, Michael and Christian.
So first of all, I wrote down, research is fun and exciting and can be calm and relaxing at the same time. This is definitely something I took away from today, because I highly appreciate researchers who are able to translate things they learn into everyday life that you can see that can make a big, big change. And I loved your question about habits and culture when she explained how the reward and the context influences your habits. Super interesting. And the thing that leaves me with room for thought is that more and more of our guests mention the climate change and that they work on it and write about it, which makes me looking to a brighter future than to a darker future. But I think we should definitely make this topic bigger. Maybe we ask a standard question about it, something like that.
Because, nice. I think that's the room I'm left.
Yeah. That's what I'm left with.
Interesting. Yeah. I had the same points. There's just one thing I want to add. I really love her voice. I love her tempo. I love the way she explains things. I mean, you already said this, and I'm so happy that I have the chance to hear it again. And I already read a lot of books about habits, but she's special. She's really special, and so proud that we had her on our show. And I have to give credits to Santje, who gave the tip that we should talk to her.
Nice.